The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and welcome back. It's Friday and the end of second week already in August, and we roll into the weekend. It's over 100 degrees out here on the west coast of Oregon today, and it's hot. It's hot all over the country. It is, I think, going to be probably maybe a record breaker. It got hot in June. Shouldn't be hot in June, and it's been hot ever since. Special guest tonight. Special program tonight. We're going to hear things that in many cases have never been spoken about on radio before or any other media through the courtesy of one of America's genius aeronautical engineers, Dr. Robert Wood. Dr. Bob Wood has been on the program in the past years ago along with his son Ryan talking about some very interesting things. But tonight we're going to talk about Bob's 47-year career. It's 47, Bob.
47. Well, actually 43 with one company, but a lot of other things since then. UFOs.
Yeah. This gentleman, Dr. Bob Wood, has been involved in probably the most secret of the projects that have never been disclosed to the American public. They, the controllers, don't feel we have a birthright to know about these things, this technology, encounters with off-planet intelligence, which is on-planet and may have been on this planet even before we were here, at least in our current incarnation as these so-called sentient species on the planet. Dr. Bob Wood, 47 years as a truly gifted aeronautical scientist. You were involved with McDonnell Douglas, Missiles in Space, for a long time, and as I mentioned to you before, I think you know my dad was there, I think at the same time you were there.
Right. I remember hearing him.
Yeah. He was there between 1959 and 1974 as Director of Public Relations for Douglas and then McDonnell Douglas. And he used to go to Vandenberg and he'd fly to the Cape for every launch that McDonnell Douglas was involved with. And he wasn't working in the black ops end of things as you were, but I think that my dad knew an awful lot more than he ever shared with me. And one time he said to me, I'm going to use a word that is commonly used. It's a little off color, but it is what it is. He looked at me and he said, and I was talking to him about missile launches, and he was describing the fight over building the space shuttle, whether we should build a space plane or the two-stage shuttle, something tied up to a Saturn rocket. There was a big argument about that back in the early days. And he was talking, and I asked him something or another, and he said, look, whatever you read about in the media or see on television, let me just say this. Keep in mind, it's all bullshit. In other words, the reality of what's going on is something that we'll never be told about. It's not in his lifetime.
Well, yeah, I certainly agree with that. Especially nowadays, I think it's even more dramatic.
Yeah, the cover-up is continuing. It's ongoing, as you know so well. When you were involved in this in the very beginning, how did you get in the door? What brought you in to the confidences of the powers that be and to the black ops end of things?
Well, actually, I really wasn't in black ops when I was working. I tell you, I did have one top secret clearance, but it just had to do with studying the ballistic missile defense of the Soviet Union, the kind of thing that you'd normally expect to be done anyway.
Yeah.
The involvement that I got in UFOs started just totally by accident, and I can briefly summarize that.
Yeah, please.
It was my boss on the occasion of General Bernard Schriever, who was retiring, was told and asked by the Air Force to give a speech the following week on how we're going to get to orbit and back in 10 years. And so he asked me if I had any opinion on it, and just for a joke, I said, well, why don't we tell him how the alleged UFOs do it? And he burst into smile and said, that's a great idea. Why don't you work on that? So actually, that was when I read my first UFO book.
That's funny. Bob, excuse me, you published a book back then on UFOs, and you didn't get taken out to the woodshed or anything?
No, I didn't publish a book. I read my first one, and then I...
Oh, you read it. I thought you said you wrote it.
Got it. No, I read it. So, and about a year later, I was called by my boss's boss to give a presentation that he normally would give. And after all this, they said, well, Dr. Wood, we don't hear from you very often. What have you been doing that's interesting? And so I told him, I said, well, you know, you're not going to believe this, but I read 50 UFO books in the last year, and I've concluded the one thing is certain, and that is that they're manned by extraterrestrials, and the only thing that's uncertain is whether we figure out how they work before or after our competitor Lockheed.
How interesting. And you were with Douglas? You were with Douglas then?
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And that was actually, it had just merged to McDonnell Douglas in 67.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So the net result of that conversation, however, was that my VP said, well, what do you think it would take to look into that? And so the net result was over the next year and a half, we spent $500,000 looking into that. We got a van to instrument it, and we hired a detective to interview abductees, hired Stan Friedman to tell us what was in the literature, did experiments in the laboratory, spun stuff in gravity fields, and then suddenly we got... They needed me to do something else, ballistic missile defense. And so that's when we canceled the program. The only thing we knew is how much we were spending.
$500,000 is a lot of money back then.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, I did some interesting thing. I got to meet Jim McDonald, and he talked me into going to see the Condon Committee. So I did go up there and talk to the Condon Committee.
Uh-huh.
And... wrote a letter suggesting to him that he divide his group up to two camps, one that they thought were believers and another the skeptics.
Uh-huh.
And I sent a copy of that to all of his committee members, and he was so upset that he wrote a letter to J.S. McDonald asking me to get fired. And I found out about this 6 weeks later, but it turned out that James McDonald didn't like university professors telling him what to do with his business. So he found out that I had that letter properly approved through the right channels, and it was graciously worded. And so, in effect, they told him to go to hell. So that's how I got started in, the, in this business. And then in 1970, they asked me to work for the next 23 years on other stuff, you know, ballistic missile defense and the Internet.
Yeah, you never really lost this intimate knowledge and attraction to the idea that the big story was that there were ETs,
right?
And we were in contact directly and indirectly. And the interesting quote, what was that quote again about Lockheed, please?
It said, it's clear that they're... manned by extraterrestrials. The only thing that's uncertain is whether or not we figure out how they work before or after our competitor Lockheed.
How funny. Now, was this suggestive that Lockheed had been given or otherwise acquired a downed craft and was back engineering it? What was the idea
on
this?
No, actually, I just picked Lockheed because they were, you know, our tough competitor
for
lots of stuff.
So it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek statement, I see.
Yeah, really. I wasn't expecting to get any money. I was just answering their question. They said, what have you been doing, Dr. Wood? That's interesting. And so it changed my career right then for the next
Bob, excuse me, but that's fascinating that this was basically a secret inquiry that you were running, right?
Well, yeah, we actually paid. It turned out we normally would have used independent research and development monies for this project.
Yeah.
But by the time that we had the opportunity to write it all up and turn it into the government to get paid, the higher management said they didn't want the government to know that we were studying this, and they paid for the whole thing out of profits.
Interesting. Did at any point in that time period someone come to you and say, listen, Bob, here's the real deal? And let you in on anything. What did you find out with that effort, that $500,000? What did you learn?
Well, we learned we didn't know how they worked. You know, we did lots of things. I mean, we interviewed a witness who claimed that, you know, she'd been abducted and was age regressed and stuff like that. And we did these experiments, but we actually didn't learn anything. And I did find out later on when... I did find out that the CIA was aware of this work, but they figured it was harmless, I guess.
Now, hold on. They're not. CIA knew about this work, your inquiry, the project, but they figured you were harmless. You weren't going to cause any real trouble. Does that suggest to you that the CIA was heavily invested in this program and knew all about it? Not yours, but I mean the idea of that they might have had down craft, that they had technology that they were trying to recreate, that what was going on here?
I was not smart enough to realize what you just said is true at that time. But now the conclusion I have is yes. They
were sitting in the catbird seat, and they say, well, all right, let's let these kids run around and see what they can find out. They're not going to cause any trouble. So, all right, this has been, like I say, Black Ops. This is various shades of gray and black. But the idea that this government, going back to Roswell and maybe Cape Girardeau and before that, and you read 50 books in 1 year? Wow.
I got excited about the subject,
I'd say.
I joined all the organizations that were, you know, APRO and MUFON and subscribed to the British journals, too. So I basically made this my hobby, focused on it for a couple of years. And then I continued to follow the field for, you know, ever since.
What was the biggest frustration for you early on in terms of how the public didn't know and the public was reporting all these things? And in the 1950s, we had stories in the newspapers practically every day for that decade, and then the lid started to come down and the stories began to disappear. Now you don't see any at all, even though we're having sightings constantly.
Yeah, well, the frustration I had in those days was that the powerful technical arguments of guys like James McDonald were just ignored by the scientific community and then totally by the press.
Tell our listeners who James McDonald was again.
James E. McDonald was a professor of... he's an aeronautics professor, I guess you might say.
Now, just for our listeners' sake, that we're not saying McDonald Douglas. It was McDonald Douglas with an LL. And we're talking about James McDonald with a D. All right.
That's correct.
Brilliant man, too. Yeah.
Yeah. He had a PhD in physics. He was at the University of Arizona, Tucson. Actually, I had a conversation with him just before he shot himself.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. But I traveled a lot on company business, and one day I happened to have an airplane that had a two-hour layover in Tucson. So I asked him, Jim, is he willing to come out and tell me what the latest is? And so he did. He agreed to, and he said, you know, Bob, I think I got it. And I said, well, what do you have? He said, well, I can't tell you. But in my judgment, what he had done is he had found some top secret material that began to clearly display how they'd been keeping this program secret with the Majestic MJ-12. That'd be my guess, is he found some MJ-12 paperwork. And at that time, nobody had heard of MJ-12.
Right. Right.
So,
he supposedly committed suicide.
Supposedly, that's right. Yeah,
nobody.
There's no evidence.
Buys
he did.
No.
Yeah.
No. He pushed very hard to expand UFO studies in the 1960s. He was really a major proponent, and his loss was a big loss. He was really a very intense man from everything I've been able to gather.
Oh, he really was, yeah. Whenever he came to town, I would take him around to, because he didn't have wheels, I'd take him around to wherever he was speaking and listen to what he said.
Yeah. Was he someone who was fascinated by this, not like a kid necessarily, but like someone who had gotten onto one of the biggest discoveries, if not the biggest discovery of our time, that we're not alone. He died at 51. I mean, he didn't kill himself.
Yeah.
This guy had too much going for him. He was absolutely dedicated to this.
Yeah, and he was an exceptionally critical scientist, I think. You know, he really would not accept data unless there was really solid evidence for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, hearsay didn't, yeah, he wasn't, he didn't jump on hearsay and go for a ride.
Right. Actually, he tried to talk me into agreeing to testify before a congressional committee that he testified on. And I talked to the guys who had involved me, you know, in this program, they said, you know, Bob, you can do whatever you like, but in our judgment, careers are rarely helped by testifying before Congress.
So I
decided that they were probably right, and so I didn't testify.
Right.
Because, you know, I could have told about the program that we'd had going, but furthermore, there was nothing to say because we weren't learning anything.
That's right. Interesting. James McDonald, one final comment about him right now. He just MIT, PhD, Iowa State University, but he really was at the top, and I don't understand why they didn't bring him in to the inner circle. But that's the understanding I have, that he was trying to force his way in through research and science and knocking on the door, maybe he got too close. I don't know. I can only guess. Okay. Tell us your view of contact in the 40s and 50s and 60s, when everything was so hot in the 1950s, which most of our listeners now don't remember, especially our younger listeners. But this was we were being inundated, overwhelmed, deluged with sightings, encounters. This was the age, the 50s and early 60s, of the contactees. Rock in California, all of that stuff was going on.
Yeah, actually, I went out to Giant Rock just for the fun of it. I wore dark glasses so nobody would recognize me. But
that's funny.
But several of our team members went out there. Those were the days when George Adamski and Von Tassel, and those, like you say, those kind of people were getting a lot of publicity. And actually, our group made a list of all the contactees in sort of a priority order as to who might be the most credible. And we had Adamski kind of towards the top of that list, which is interesting because it was Adamski's work, I think, that stimulated Ron Garner to originally get into this back in those days.
Uh-huh. Did you ever see that photograph of George Adamski's stomach? There's a photograph out there, and his navel was odd. It looked like it had radiating lines coming out from it in the 360-degree radius around the circumference. Yeah, it's a very odd thing. He claimed it was either done to him or he was born that way. It was a strange anomaly. I remember seeing that picture once. But so your information back then was that Adamski was credible and legit.
Well,
and
no, we.
What did you think?
We sort of speculated around it, and we were thinking in terms of probability. My view was that there might be probably more than 50% that he was kind of telling the truth. But that's where we left it. We didn't.
Okay.
We didn't really do anything.
All right.
That.
Very good. Now, the legendary and absolute classic motion picture, Dr. Strangelove, the man in the wheelchair. Edward Teller was the man in the wheelchair too. This is a very interesting story. Tell us about Edward Teller and his alleged encounters with the Nordics, the tall blondes.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because the first time I saw that report was actually when I was reading Ron Garner's, well, listening to Ron Garner and reading his material. I don't know what he...
Let's tell our listeners about Ron Garner first. Let's do that.
Yeah, well, Ron Garner was a guy that I met in the late 90s when I was involved and active in the local UFO organization. He would come to our local mutual UFO network meetings in Orange County.
Uh-huh.
And would start to, you know, begin to claim that he was learning some really important stuff. And actually, in the late 90s, I think he began to have an idea for some movies. He, you know, he had always big plans.
Mm-hmm.
He had apparently made contact with Anonymous, which
right.
was back in 1999, I think. And he was the one who, with this contact, was able to get Linda Moulton Howe to go out and interview Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
But he was sufficiently active that he became friends and with various people. He became friends with me because he was looking for money. And he felt that I could probably afford to lend him $1,000 to do a little extra printing. And actually, I did. I lent him some money.
Right.
Never got it back, of course. But
no, that's the way it is. Lending means giving. It's a foreign word that was never adequately translated.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, he later approached in about 2005, I think, approached the Mutual UFO Network of Orange County, who actually had some money for a few thousand dollars to pay for plane fare to go to interview another witness. And so it turned out that it was good because that related to, I think, the recent exposure of Anonymous on video.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, Ron Garner and I became sufficiently friendly, and he knew MUFON of Orange County because we'd helped him, that when he became ill, you know, so ill that he thought he was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
He invited Jan Harzan, who our local leader is, and now he's the director.
Yeah, Jan's a great guy. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Jan turned to me and he said, "Well, Ron Garner wants to make a sort of a death statement. Do you want to come?" And so I said yes. So on the 23rd of January this, you know, 2015,
mm-hmm.
Not this year, last year,
right.
We went and listened to what he said for a couple hours. And in those couple hours was the first time I heard the report, as I recall, that the teller was there at Area S4 and was maybe being taught by Nordics, you know. Mm-hmm. That's really, really interesting stuff. So, and actually, this 2 hours was basically Ron Garner trying to tell two people and everything that he knew so that it could be published in the MUFON Journal. That's what he was hoping for. We did publish one article, but I learned a lot of things just listening to him that he believed, and I'm not sure that everything he believed was true.
How credible was his display of knowledge and the way he was talking about these things? Did it sound completely legit?
He was totally confident that what he was saying was the truth. He was saying, you know, here you guys are going to hear what's really true. You're not going to believe it, but this is what's true, guys. This is the way the world has been working. And so he absolutely believed that what he was saying was true. And so I sucked in these ideas, and I concluded that some of them were pretty interesting. Some of them were not consistent with other things that I knew.
Right.
But, you know.
Were the conflicts terminal in nature, or just different angles of the same?
No, not really. He said, for example, that Admiral McConnell was the soul of the Majestic program. He was MJ-1.
Mm-hmm.
And that VP Cheney and Greenspan were also members.
Yeah, that's an odd. I looked at one point of an alleged compendium of the members of MJ-12. That Kissinger, there's some odd people in there that you wouldn't think necessarily would be there. Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Yeah.
I mean, are these the most powerful men on the planet? Some people argue, yeah. Kissinger, a World War II Jeep driver for American generals. He's gone a long way, as they say. Dr. Edward Teller, supposedly known colloquially as the father of the hydrogen bomb, Hungarian-American, very interesting man. I can see him being tabbed to work with ETs on an interim basis, at least,
yeah,
if not long-term.
Yeah, I agree. What I was going to say in answer to your question was, what was it that I wasn't quite sure of what he said?
Yeah.
I think that the actual list that he gave me of who was on MJ-12, I questioned how current it really was at that time. And he was talking really a few years before that. But he said, the one thing that surprised me and excited me was that Dan Burrish was on MJ-12 at one time and was replaced by Carol Ann Thatcher, the daughter of Margaret Thatcher.
You know, that's a Thatcher. Ah.
Yeah.
I knew the name. Yeah. I've seen her picture, and I didn't know it was Margaret Thatcher's daughter. How interesting.
Yeah, so, but anyway, his... I questioned the confidence that I should have on who exactly are the members of MJ-12 today. And he said, well, every so often they vote, and usually they vote to release it to the public, and the vote changes every year. And the last time that was September 2005, he said the vote was 8-3 in favor of releasing it. But
Of releasing it, meaning disclosure, telling people the truth.
Right, but my opinion today, which is actually modulated quite a bit from what I thought a couple of years ago, is that the disclosure is so complex. If in fact the secret space program is real, that MJ-12 is just one of the minor players.
That is an interesting observation. It would be almost a sideline operation. There's something really much bigger than MJ-12 running the show.
Yeah, that's, and the thing that, as you know, I wound up meeting Bill Tompkins, who, and I helped edit his book.
Well, you did. Yes. What are your thoughts right now of the space, so-called Solar Warden, outer space program run by the U.S. Navy?
Well, the one thing that I learned from meeting and hearing Bill Tompkins' story,
fascinating stories,
that the Navy was the first to really understand what needed to be done. In my judgment, they took the craft that they got in the Battle of L.A. in 1942, and they started reverse engineering that craft, and they did it well, and I think that the Navy's Navy League actually has a classified action function, and they're the ones who probably built the craft, Solar Warden craft, if in fact the Solar Warden program is true.
Well, you've heard Bill on this program talk about the Navy League. I mean, it was the irony of it is it where Bill was the director or president of the Navy League chapter was where I am, and this all happened right here. It's just very strange. Now you said something I want to go back to, but before we go back, let me just run down a list here. This is the so-called list of MJ-12, the group, and this is defined by Dr. Dan Burrish, also known as Dan Crane. I've had Dan on the program a number of times in the past. He's a very enigmatic presence. Let me just
I met Dan because Ron said, "Would you like to meet Dan Bush?" And I said, "Well, sure." And so he dropped Dan off at my house, and Dan and I chatted for a couple hours.
Yeah,
but by ourselves.
Fascinating, yeah. Fascinating stories from him. Remarkable experiences. Again, they're just kind of overwhelming when you hear them, and you don't know what you don't know what to think. Here are the people supposedly on the MJ-12 group as of 2005. John Michael McConnell, the two L's. He's a vice admiral, born 1943. Richard Bruce Dick Cheney, probably on his fifth heart transplant by now, a man who is still in search of a heart. According
to me,
he's number two. And number three, Porter Goss, former director of CIA, succeeded George Tenet. Number four, Bobby Ray Inman. Admiral, Director of National Intelligence, and other things. Bobby Ray Inman is one of those names that most people don't know, but he is, if it's to be known, Bobby Ray Inman would probably know it.
Let me hesitate for a second. Did you know that Bill Tompkins said that Bobby Ray Inman was the guy who was giving him instructions when he was in 1951, when he was in his think tank?
He did mention that at one point in the many hours of conversations we had. I do remember that. Number five is Henry Kissinger. Number six is Zbigniew Brzezinski. Number seven, Richard Myers, General United States Air Force, former chairman of the JCS under George Herbert Walker Bush. Number eight, Sir Kevin Reginald Tebbit, British Permanent Undersecretary of Defense. Carol Ann Thatcher, number nine, Margaret Thatcher's daughter. Number 10, Alan Greenspan. I guess they had to put a monetary economist in there somewhere. Harold Varmus is number 11, Nobel scientist, Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. And number 12 is E.M. Kelly, IBM Senior Vice President and Director of Research. That supposedly is the MJ-12 group as of 2005.
Well, the names that you mentioned all correlate with what Ron Garner said.
Was that Garner's statement recorded? Did they run a tape when he was talking?
Yeah, it's recorded. Mm-hmm. But it's recorded. But I took the recording and my notes and added them together and created a three-page document that in effect says what all happened. If you're interested in that, I could send that to you. I don't think it's ever been published.
No, I'd like to see it. I won't publish it. That'd be very interesting, Bob. Thank you.
He didn't mention several of the names that you mentioned.
Uh-huh.
So your source was different from Ron's?
My sources, I just pulled up, it's a MUFON page. And it's
a MUFON page? Oh.
Yeah. It's a MUFON page, and let me see here. It's headed with the words Majestic 12 Group as defined by Dr. Dan Burrish, a.k.a. Dan Crane. So as of October 2005. Yeah. This is Dan Burrish's version of it.
Right, okay. Exactly. And that's what Ron would have said. If we'd asked him, he would have said that Dan gave him this. Mm-hmm. But he didn't mention that on the tape.
Mm-hmm.
But it's consistent.
Now, you said something that really caught my attention, because I knew somebody who was an air raid warden in Los Angeles in February of 1942, the Battle of L.A., and she told me a story that I will never forget. Her phone rang. It was early in the morning or late at night, one or the other. And her boss, whoever the air raid warden supervisor was for her area, said, "Get your hat on and get outside. We're being attacked and they're firing." And she said, "Yeah, I've been hearing the guns." And so she was living in Culver City, and she said, "I looked outside and I looked up, and the searchlights had this thing pegged, and there was anti-aircraft going off all around it." And she said the object, the craft, was moving very slowly. I guess it would have been northeast to southwest or something like that. And she said it was the most beautiful thing I have ever seen. She told me this in her 80s.
Interesting.
Described the color and all that. And now you said something after the Navy recovered the craft or the object from the Battle of Los Angeles. Does that mean that that craft did in fact go into the drink as it passed over Long Beach? It was damaged and it went down.
Well, there's a letter from Marshall to FDR stating what happened. It's a top secret letter. It's one of the many documents that I have researched and tried to authenticate. But this one stated what I just said, namely that there were two craft that were shot down. One was recovered by the Army in the San Bernardino Mountains, and one was salvaged by the Navy at sea.
Yeah, I've heard about that one. The one at sea, people said it slowly went out over the ocean and disappeared. And someone else told me not too long ago that it allegedly went down. I mean, it took a terrible amount of abuse from the anti-aircraft. You can see pictures of the Battle of L.A., and yeah. How something could withstand that much punishment. I guess it didn't.
There's only one photo. Yeah.
This friend
one
of mine
shows it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The friend of mine who was the warden said that there were groups of American fighter aircraft taking. They would come and turn, and she said, and they go right at this thing, firing their guns. She saw it. And that's never been admitted to. But we think one of our aircraft was shot down by friendly fire. I think that landed in El Monte or somewhere, and they took it away on a low boy. I think it was an American fighter aircraft. But we did have planes up, and they were shooting at this thing too. In addition to the AA.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
She swore up. I asked her. I said, "Are you sure?" She said, "Yeah, I watched them. They'd line up three or four abreast, and they'd go right at this thing, and then they'd turn, and then the next group would come at it." So they had, I guess, six or eight planes up there at least shooting at it.
So you interviewed her on your program?
I sat in a house with her. She was a friend.
Oh, okay.
This was a woman who was a friend of mine for several years.
She's not alive still? Or?
No, she's passed.
Okay.
But, I don't think she exaggerated anything. She didn't really even raise the issue. She mentioned something about something when I mentioned Battle of L.A., and she said, "Oh, yeah, I saw that," or something like that. And I said, "What?" And yeah, she told me the story. So, okay, the letter from George C. Marshall. You authenticating things is very hard to do. There's so many details. What did you come up with? What is your feeling about the authenticity of that letter? And what did the letter say? Anything more than the Navy recovered something that crashed in the ocean?
Yes, it did. Unfortunately, I don't have it with me. Maybe after the break, I could go back and read you portions of that letter.
Yeah, that'd be fun. We got a break coming up in about 15 minutes, something like that. Okay, so if the Navy did recover something and the Army got something, that would lead to me, the suggestion of a typical service rivalry. They wouldn't necessarily work together.
Exactly.
They'd try and do their own thing. Am I right?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And they have the FBI and the Army who got the Cape Girardeau craft, in my judgment.
Oh, they got that too.
Yeah. Well, the Cape Girardeau craft was in 41 or 2.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's what he started with. And then this craft, these two craft, were in 42.
Same time period. So.
Yeah.
Did you hear anything else about occupants or anything, any specifics in all of your years of research, of digging into this, about those early craft?
The only ones where occupants are mentioned was the Cape Girardeau.
Mm-hmm.
And the others, I've never seen any reference to occupants, but the only reference I have to the Battle of L.A. crashes, those two, is just this one letter.
Interesting. Interesting. Very interesting. Again, if you folks ever do any research, there was, and I think it was El Monte, the city of El Monte, there was something crashed there, and a low boy was brought in, and whatever it was taken out with tarps over it, and it might well have been an American fighter plane.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. El Monte was the word. Okay.
I think that was the location. pretty sure.
Okay.
So you might look into that, and maybe you've got something on it somewhere.
Okay.
Now, the Battle of Los Angeles, for those of you who don't know, probably the biggest UFO sighting encounter maybe in history, one of them anyway. A couple of million people watch this thing happen for hours at night, or not hours, but a long time. And it was an object, at least one, passed right over Culver City, moving on down toward Long Beach. And the Americans, of course, right after Pearl Harbor, had put in a lot of anti-aircraft, thinking the Japanese might possibly attack Los Angeles or Southern California. And they all opened up on this thing, and now we're hearing the possibility that would confirm what I heard, that something did eventually go into the ocean off Long Beach.
1,430 rounds of ammunition fired, mm-hmm. and that was unclassified, that was published. But, you know, I don't know whether it was one of the things that Bill Tompkins might have mentioned on your program, but he was there that night, and he said that there were multiple UFOs, not just one, the one they were shooting at, but several.
Right. I need to get into that next time Bill comes on the program. There had to be multiple if two went down, so sure.
Yeah, not only that, he claims, I guess you'd say it's a claim, that he was illuminated by a bright light from the ocean before any of the shooting started that night, and he kind of thinks or implies that that's when he was, quote, selected by extraterrestrials, which is the title of his book.
What an interesting thing, illuminated by a beam of light.
Yeah, and, you know, he doesn't really know.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't a searchlight. He'd know that, that's for sure.
No, it was from a UFO out in the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which might have been an underwater submersible, USO, at the time. Who knows?
Yeah. But anyway, that I think is mentioned in the book, but in any case, that is the reason for the title of the book.
Very interesting. Okay. Let me go back with Dr. Teller and the Nordics. What else do you know about that? Anything? What did you come across?
Well, the only thing that I have is the quotes from Dan Bush. I think he said a couple times, he says, I'll give you exactly what it said. He saw Edward Teller with these two beings. This is Bill Newhouse, okay? I saw Edward Teller with these two beings, Nordics, who were teaching Edward Teller about science.
Wow.
And then he also alludes to see the book Stranger in the Pentagon, which I've read, but it's a long time ago. And then, let's see, some other place, Teller paid for Dan Burrish's education, allegedly, at the State University of New York. And then another place that he has said Edward Teller was seen to be trained by the Nordics, too. So he mentioned that three times in his kind of death statement that I heard. But I didn't have any other information about that other than what's in the Burrish's reports. Ron Garner, would have liked to have been a very prolific publisher.
Uh-huh.
And he has actually four things that have been sort of published. One of them is the book Anonymous, which I'm sure you know about, which is the story of Cooper or Stein that Linda Moulton Howe put on her website back early in 2000. But that book does have a few pages of the beginning that talks about Ron Garner's involvement. And then he has a book called Alien Disclosure Area 51, which is spiral bound. And that is mostly Dan Burrish. And then he has... Then he has a three-ring binder, which is just stuffed full of material that has never been published, but it includes things like Operation High Jump, the actual diary of what Admiral Byrd said, allegedly.
Hold on. The actual diary of Admiral Byrd.
That's what he claimed, yeah.
The actual typewritten original?
No, not the typewritten. Well, it's typewritten, so...
A transcription of the diary, okay.
Yeah, a transcription of the diary, right. And then he has a Russian documentary which claims how they believed that Hitler actually did make it to Antarctica, and that the Russians, the submarines, the Nazi submarines had such long periscopes that we never detected them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he has multiple sections on the whistleblowers, more on Corso as well as Dan Burrish and Bill Uhouse and Robert Lazar.
All very, very controversial names in the field.
All controversial, yeah. But the theme that he purported to espouse was that their stories basically are in high harmony with each other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to suggest one thing, if I can, Bob.
Yes.
The book from Harry Cooper called Hitler in Argentina. If you haven't read it, it's a must read for you.
Oh.
Hitler in Argentina. And if you go to sharkhunters.com, you'll find it right there. Sharkhunters.com. Harry's a regular guest on the program. It's the number one historical organization for documenting and collating and collecting information about the U-boats of World War II, American submarines, a lot of German stuff. But the core of the book is really rooted into this something like 160 pages, if I'm remembering right, of handwritten memories of a Spanish-born SS intelligence officer who was in the bunker.
Oh, wow. That sounds right.
It is absolutely fascinating.
Okay.
You got to get the book. It's all there. Harry first put the book out over 20 years ago called Escape from the Bunker, and I urged him, and he agreed, and he has updated it. It is a knockout, and it's all predicated on eyewitness testimony, not just rumor. It's a fascinating book. Hitler in Argentina. You must read it. I think it'll answer a lot of questions.
What's Harry's last name?
Cooper.
Cooper.
He runs sharkhunters.com. It's an historic research organization, and it is fascinating.
Again. Wonderful.
All right.
Thank you
for
the lead.
Oh, you're welcome. I really think it's going to add a lot to your... It's going to pull a lot of things together for you. Hitler would never have gone down in a submarine. He hated cramped space. He's seasick.
Interesting.
There was a Junkers 390 six engine. They only made two of them. The third one never flew. And that plane, it is believed, flew probably. He and Eva Braun and a lot of other high-ranking people and lots of money and lots of booty on a flight to Argentina. Hitler lived there with his wife. We have photos of the house that was built by the Mercedes family for him on the lake at Bariloche, Argentina. He lived there from 1955 to the early 60s, and then moved to Cordoba, or 1945 to the, let's say 1945 to 1955 in Bariloche, and from 55 to 62 in Cordoba when he died. He died down there of old age. Very interesting.
Well, now that's a story the media won't touch.
Never. No. However, my remote viewing friends have touched it. Dick Allgaier has remote viewed the death of Adolf Hitler.
Wow.
And as you know, remote viewers are not front-loaded. They don't know what they're viewing. And
right, exactly.
It took him a long time during the process to figure out who he couldn't figure out. This man is very famous. He's a big, major figure in history, and who is it? And he kept coming up with more pieces. He actually got inside his mind when he was dying. Remote viewers can do amazing things, or at least that's the story.
Yeah, so, my son uses remote viewers when necessary.
There you go. All right, well,
yeah.
It's on my homepage, the entire interview with Dick about He actually produced a documentary about remote viewing, The Death of Adolf Hitler. I got to narrate it, and that's on my homepage as well. You can look at that documentary and see Dick actually working in trance, or whatever you want to call it, on a whiteboard and describing what he is seeing and what he is feeling about this old man who is on his deathbed in Argentina. It's quite a story. Okay.
So what's your homepage? It wouldn't hurt for everybody here.
Just Rents, R-E-N-S-E, Rents.com.
Got it.
And Frank, maybe you could find that for him. It's on the right-hand side. Dick Allgaier, Remote Viewing the Death of Adolf Hitler. And just send the link right to Bob, and he can get right at it. We have a break break coming up here in a minute. When we come back, it'll be about 6 or 7 minutes, we'll continue our conversation. And lots more ahead. Ron Garner is a very interesting fellow. We'll talk more about him, talk more about Solar Warden. I'm also curious about your current thoughts about Dan Burrish.
Yes.
And the others. There are several in there who, you know, they took a lot of heat at times. I like Dan. He's been on the program, I bet, at least 6-8 times in years gone by. And just a fascinating story.
And then, is he still alive, as far as you know?
As far as I know. Yeah,
yeah,
far
good.
As I know. Yeah, yeah. And the lady who was with him used to come on as well. Interesting story, just fascinating story. All right, Bob, hang on, and we'll come right back and continue. Our guest is Dr. Robert Wood, aeronautical engineer and all-around wizard, and we'll continue in just a few minutes.